I'm Vicky Mochama, and this is No Little Plans, a podcast about the UN Sustainable Development Goals in Canada. In 2015, the United Nations announced an ambitious mission: leave no one behind. They came up with 17 goals to achieve just that. Canada is also accountable. We have until 2030, like everyone else around the world, to make sure that we've hit all the goals. And we've got just 11 years to go, which seems like a long time, until you realize that there's a lot of work left to do. On the last season of No Little Plans, we talked about poverty, homelessness, gender, and the health of our seas and oceans. However, with 17 goals in the SDG program, there's still plenty more to get into. And that's exactly what we're going to do over the next 6 episodes. On this episode, we are looking at goal number 2, zero hunger. If you're lucky, you know where your next meal is coming from. You know that you can pop by a grocery store or grab some takeout and feed yourself whenever you're hungry. You might even say, and I say this all the time, I'm starving, before ordering a pizza for delivery on your phone. Knowing that you can get enough nutritious, culturally appropriate, and affordable food means you are food secure. If you are food insecure, that can mean you just can't get what you need from the grocery store, and you can't afford to get takeout on a whim. If you are food insecure, saying something like, I'm starving, might mean that you truly have not eaten all day. So here's something I didn't know, and it's a piece of research I ran across. According to the University of Toronto's food insecurity researchers, 1 in 8 households in Canada is food insecure. But what that really means in terms of the numbers is over 4 million Canadians. Of those, over 1 million are children, living in homes struggling to put food on the table. Food insecurity is felt differently depending on where you live in Canada. And in the north, the picture is a bleak one. In the Northwest Territories, for example, 29% of children live in food insecurity. In Nunavut, almost half of all households are food insecure. So this episode, we're focusing on Canada's north and how food insecurity affects people who live there. So I wanted to know, what is it like to try to get groceries in food insecure areas? To find out, we caught up with grocery shoppers in Rankin Inlet, Nunavut, to ask them about what they were buying.
And what are you buying today?
Well, I got family over today, so I'm buying steaks and cut them into stir fry. Cheaper. I hardly shop here. I shop in Winnipeg when we go down, maybe once or twice a month, because the prices here are ridiculous.
What are you buying today?
Some stuff for nachos and wings.
And how much do you think it'll cost for something for nachos and wings?
Probably about $100.
Really? Is that an exaggeration?
Well, no, because I'm putting hamburger meat and stuff in nachos and cheese and, yeah.
Like, just to buy, like, laundry detergent, if you want to buy, like, say, Tide Pods, 120-pack is $60. That's the way it is.
A can of pop costs, like, $3, and the chips is, like, $2.50.
Weather is bad, the planes aren't flying, the store empties out pretty fast.
I heard they double their prices.
Double the price relative to down south?
Yeah.
Wow. Does the price affect what you're going to buy here?
Not really, because it's expensive anyway, so yeah.
Isaac line one, please. Isaac line one.
It's cheaper for your kids to drink pop than it is to have juice, apple juice or cranberry juice or any kind of juice like that. And they're on one side of the aisle.
And the pop isn't cheap either.
No. It's cheaper than trying to buy juice.
In a nutshell, is there a way to save money on food up here?
Yeah, bring it in when you're out on medical or something. Yeah, just load it up and bring it back.
What did you bring last time you left?
Like a couple of tubs of just meat. $300 worth of meat down south is like last us like 3 months here.
All right, thank you so much.
All right.
A can of pop, a bag of chips, ground meat. These are fairly standard things to have in your kitchen. Outside of the north, if they're too pricey for you, you can put them back. You can go comparison shopping. You can decide to eat something else. But what do you do when you're priced out of buying any of the food that is there? To get a picture of what food insecurity means to people in the North, I spoke to Wade Thorhaug, the executive director of the Kayuktavik Food Center in Iqaluit. The food center serves a daily lunch where anywhere between 80 and 100 people show up. All in all, they make around 200 meals on average during lunch, preparing enough for people to have seconds and takeouts as well. They also provide food training services to make sure people have the skills to prepare food and get employment. I asked Wade if he thought the center was making a dent in the number of people who are food insecure or who have lack of access to healthy and sustainable foods.
In the grand scheme of things, the biggest contributor to the food insecurity in their lives is going to be poverty, not having the means to buy the foods that they want, be it lack of employment, or even people who do have employment, sometimes they have they live in overcrowded houses where they have more than five people depending on that single income, or they could have substance abuse problems which limit their spending power and also sort of jeopardize their ability to hold down city employment. And also on top of that, I mean, we have the highest food costs in the country paired with some of the highest poverty rates in the country as well.
Let's talk about some of those stats. One third of people, according to Statistics Canada in Nunavut, are food insecure, but that hasn't always been the case. Can you tell us what the food landscape looked like in the North maybe 100, 200 years ago?
Right. So even up until, say, the 1950s, you would still have almost everybody in the population eating foods that were produced and harvested locally. And by that, I mean foods harvested from the land, particularly sea mammals, whales, seals, but also things like fish and caribou, walruses. The biggest change happened when we had settlements started in the 50s. And what that did was that when you had people who moved several times a year to follow the movements of animals that they depended on, when you no longer have the means to make those seasonal movements, then you're obviously limited in the capacity to harvest food from the land. So there was the settlement in the communities, but also there was the infamous dog slaughter of the dogs teams that people use to make these seasonal movements.
Let's take a minute and talk about the dog slaughter that Wade is referring to. In the 1950s and 60s, the RCMP and other authorities killed sled dogs that they no longer considered healthy. To many Inuit, though, the sled dogs were killed for no reason. Many elders still remember viscerally the day their dogs were killed. For many Inuit, it is a tragic point and a flashpoint for when life began to change for the worse. Their sled dogs are what allowed them to hunt and to stay connected with the land. So, along with the arrival of settlements and the expansion of residential schools, the dog slaughter meant that not only were they now increasingly disconnected from the land and from their children, their own food had become harder and even at times illegal to get. Food security in the North is then not just about the price of onions and chicken. It's also about what the land can provide. Wade says residential schools also limited parents' ability to pass down harvest knowledge to their children. This includes knowledge of how to gather, prepare, and serve country food. Seal meat, whale meat, the outer layers of whales, char, cod, caribou, polar bears, walruses, berries, and even clams. But just because that knowledge was limited doesn't mean it's gone.
Luckily, the food system as it was has not been entirely destroyed. So even younger generations have grown up eating a lot of country food. And so for almost everybody here, it's a delicacy. It's something they crave. It's something that they find very wholesome, very important food in the community.
The food center would not be what it is without a chef, Trudy Metcalf-Coe. Trudy is from Northern Labrador, and over time, she moved away from the North. She stopped eating country food. It wasn't until she was 22 years old that she finally got back in touch. Trudy is retired and loves to cook. When she heard about this temporary position, she jumped at the chance. For her, cooking is a thing of passion, especially when it means promoting country food.
I think it's really, really important that we do as much as we can with country food for our clients and the Inuit, because it's a part of who we are. Like, it's, I don't know how to explain it other than we need it, we crave it, we desire it. It's not just that, oh, I feel like having caribou tonight. It's like, I need to have caribou tonight. I mean, for people who live here, to go to the grocery store and buy things out of the freezer, you know, steak or chicken or pork chops or whatever. I mean, it's all available, yes. But we grow up on it. I mean, it's a part of our diets. And I think if you ask almost any Inuk, if you offer them caribou or beef, they're going to choose caribou.
Trudy told me about a recent meal that she made at the food center.
Like at the center, I was making char the other day. We had some Arctic char in the freezer. And it's like, oh, you know, I'm going to cook this up. So I went in there really early in the morning, and there was probably about, I'm going to guess, maybe 30 Arctic char that I had pulled from the freezer the day or a couple of days before. And, you know, I had to clean them all, and I cut them all up, and we fried them up, and we had like a country food meal that day. We had Arctic char, we had palauga, which is like a bread that we make. We had muktuk, which is a part of the whale, like the outer part of the whale, which is another favorite of Inuit. And it was just a great day. Everybody's coming in. It's like, oh, Arctic char, yum. And, you know, oh, muktuk. And people were just so happy to have all this food. And it's all country food. And we served that with, like, you know, we had mashed potatoes and we have some green beans. And we had a salad and dessert. So it was like everything all put together, like not just all Inuit food. It was a mixture of food from up here and then food that we bring up from the south. Yeah, it's just, we need it.
I asked Trudy what it costs for her to eat, because I'm hearing all that and wondering what people in the north are putting in their shopping baskets. Like, how do you even get country food?
I mean, up here, it's so expensive for people to go to the grocery store. I came here last Sunday. I went to the grocery store, and just to get started for the month, buying some basics, you know, buying some milk and some cheese and butter and, you know, a loaf of bread and a box of cereal and, you know, a couple of some veggies and a couple of proteins, I spent $163, and there was only enough food, literally enough food for me to make four meals for myself, and then, you know, four real meals and then the basics on the side. $163. And it's like, that's like not even enough food for me for the week, for example. And just coffee, you know, coffee and tea and, you know, bread. People make a lot of Inuit make their own bread, like their own palauga. It's palauga, bannock, some people like different names. Because very simple ingredients, and it's a staple. It's something that did come with colonization. We didn't have flour. You know, traditionally Inuit were meat eaters, right? Fish and meat. A few things off the land, like for making tea or something, or no vegetation really. So we've always been meat eaters. Eggs, when in the springtime, when the ducks are returning and laying eggs and stuff like that, we would get fresh. I remember as a child going out and collecting fresh eggs when I was about 5 or 6 years old, because we didn't get eggs all winter long. And then looking forward to going out to the islands and getting some eggs. And, you know, and of course, me with the ice going and the seals are available. And so there's different foods at different times. And not everybody has the means to go out hunting. They don't have a skidoo and they don't have a boat and stuff like that. And you can't get these animals near community anymore. Char, for here in Iqaluit, we can kind of walk to the river where there's char, but then you need to have... I went char fishing on Saturday, and I lost 3 hooks. So right there, it's $25 that I lost, and I didn't get anything. So if we can imagine an individual who doesn't have that, who can't afford to lose 3 hooks in a time and walk away with nothing... Yeah, not only are they not able to feed their family, but they've lost $25 in equipment.
And yet for Trudy, working at the food center excites her. I had to know what keeps her motivated.
I mean, there's been a lot of people, because of the food insecurity, don't have the opportunity to cook. I just feel so good about this program. Everybody's just so capable. they're young students and they're learning, but... I don't even have to, you know, be on their back and saying, okay, guys, you know, well, if you've done that, now you have to do this and do this and do this. I mean, it's like, they just know what they're doing. It's like a really well-oiled machine, all of us there together. And I just can't thank them enough. Every time I, like, every day is like, oh my God, I appreciate you guys so much. Because I've worked in kitchens where it's like pulling teeth, getting somebody to peel a carrot. But here it's like they're eager. They know what needs to be done. They know that, you know, we're going to have all these people coming through the door at noon and we want them coming through. And they're really keen on making sure that things are clean and people are going to enjoy the food. And like they're saying, oh, you know, they're so happy. It's like, oh, so-and-so said this was really good. It's the, you know, even just a simple thing, like the best mashed potatoes he's ever had. And it's like, and then letting the person know, whoever made the mashed potatoes, like, you got a good compliment today. You know, so-and-so is like, you know, it's an elder. And they said they were like the best mashed potatoes they ever had. And, you know, they take that to heart, right? All these little things. And I just love it. It's like, why did I only say I'm coming for 6 months? I have a family in Ottawa. Yes, it's reason to go home. But at the same time, I know when it's time to go, I'm going to kind of like, wow, are there any centers in Ottawa that do this? Because it's amazing. You know, I can't even find the words to describe how it makes me feel to be able to go in there every day and see community coming in and enjoying it and feeling that they're cared for. Like we actually care for them. And seeing the students with learning their skills and helping out and stuff like that. And they're actually, it does something to them to know that they're taking care of community also. And because it's a small community. Iqaluit itself is like 8,000 people, but you know, as Inuit, we all know each other. There's only 60,000 of us across Canada. I know almost all the Inuit in the Baffin region itself, the 13 communities, because of previous work. And you know, just to see the people that we have, the students that we have working there, and how proud they are to be serving and taking care of the community and being a part of a great thing. I can't even find words. I can't find words.
Giselle Yasmin is the executive director of Food Secure Canada, an organization that is committed to zero hunger, establishing a sustainable food system, and providing access to safe and healthy food. Food Secure Canada played a big part in establishing the first ever Canadian national food policy. This is also a big plan, like our SDGs, that aims to make sure that all people in Canada have access to a sufficient amount of safe, nutritious, and culturally diverse food. The policy has a budget of $134 million spread out over 5 years. Within that total, there are $50 million allocated to supporting local food infrastructures and $15 million towards supporting northern communities. If those numbers sound big, it's because they are. And the money matters a lot because the costs of food insecurity are ballooning. For example, there are big health costs associated with hunger and food insecurity, from mental health costs to prescription drugs to costs associated with more chronic issues like diabetes and HIV. According to Proof, a research institute you'll hear about soon, a food insecure person in Ontario incurs health costs around $1,600 a year. Compare that to a severely food insecure person whose health costs are over twice that amount. That's where the Canada Food Policy comes in. It was launched in June 2019. For Food Secure Canada, it has been a long time coming. What is different for a northern community that a community maybe in the southern portions of Canada? What is the challenge for them in terms of accessing food?
Well, there's the distances. So there are things like transport. For example, you know, how much do you pay for milk in an southern urban setting versus in northern rural and remote communities? You pay a lot more because of the price of transportation. There are also issues related to, you know, having locally produced food available or not. So in urban areas, for example, I lived a long time in Vancouver. There are extensive market gardens all around Greater Vancouver. So if you if we equate healthy eating with eating a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables, there's more abundance locally than there is, for example, in rural and remote communities. But there's also land rights and access to hunting and fishing and living off the land, particularly for indigenous communities, which plays a huge role in food security as well. And the other factor I would mention is imposing southern diets on northerners, which sometimes can actually lead to chronic disease, obesity, type 2 diabetes, etc. So, you know, there, for example, are problems with junk food, for example, and that is often related to poverty as well. So, you know, there are a host of factors that are at play when it comes to rural and remote communities and northern food insecurity in particular.
So I guess in that last example, it'd be something like it's cheaper to buy junk food than it might necessarily be to get fresh fruits and vegetables in northern communities.
Yes, I mean, that is a factor. And that's also a factor, you know, in southern urban areas. So often, sometimes the healthiest food is actually more expensive. So then that exacerbates the issue for poor households. We just published a report called Sustainable Consumption for All, improving the accessibility of sustainably produced foods in Canada, healthy and sustainable foods. And that was one of our major conclusions, was that a lot of families would like to eat better, but they can't afford to do so.
Basic starting block. Being food insecure can set you back massively, and not just on that day, but really, like Giselle said, it can mean running into more obstacles for the rest of your life. A right to food security is really about breaking up a cycle of poverty and hunger that can echo throughout your life. We've talked about the high cost of food in northern communities. You heard earlier how nachos and wings can set you back $100. A big reason why is because of transportation costs. It costs a lot of money to send these things to isolated northern communities, but it's the people there who pay the price. That's why the Canadian government launched the Nutrition North program in April of 2011. Their plan was this: subsidize staples and groceries to make them more affordable. The government would provide a subsidy to the retailer, who would then offset the costs of certain foods. That money would subsidize things like fruits and vegetables, milk, eggs, meat, and cheese. And while this does bring down some costs, there's research to show that Nutrition North hasn't done much to alleviate food insecurity in northern communities. To find out more about this, I spoke to Valerie Tarasek, who is a professor in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Toronto. She's also the lead investigator at PROOF, the Food Insecurity Policy Research Institute run at the university. She has worked for decades to study food insecurity in Canada. Has Nutrition North made a dent in the level of food insecurity in the North?
It doesn't look like it. We did an examination using the monitoring data that we had access to. I had a very talented doctoral student, Andréanne Fafard Saint-Germain, and she did an examination of changes in food insecurity rates in 10 communities in Nunavut that were a part of this Nutrition North program. And so looking at the rates of food insecurity before and during the implementation of the new program and then afterwards, what she saw is that rates went up. It's substantially up. And that's consistent with what we've been seeing just looking at cross-sectionally at the monitoring data as it's been coming forward over these last few years from Nunavut. We can see rates of food insecurity in that area are rising. And so what she did, though, was just isolate communities that absolutely had been recipients of Nutrition North Canada and see that even when we narrow down the focus to that area, we're still seeing a substantial increase in food insecurity over this period. You know, you can subsidize food prices until you're blue in the face, but at the end of the day, somebody's ability to access food also is a function of the money in their purse. And if all you do is pay attention to the price of food and subsidize it in some trivial way, and you don't do anything with that money in the purse, then there's nothing to say that the two things will balance out. So, you know, I think even the notion that the way to fix this problem was to subsidize a fixed list of commodities is, you know, suggests that nobody was really doing their homework very well. It's very concerning, and it's especially concerning given that just a few months ago we had the federal government pour more money onto the program. But, you know, I think this is symptomatic of a bigger problem related to people's attempts to address food insecurity. There's a lot of intervention that happens that is not evidence-based and that isn't rooted in any real thinking about what's driving the problem and therefore what should drive the solution.
I'd love then to get your sense of Canada's new food policy, and it's meant to be this more thorough and exhaustive set of policies around food security and insecurity than we've had before.
I think it's a huge step backwards. I was really, really disappointed to see that policy. I don't even believe that food insecurity should be in that policy. But the idea that, I mean, repeatedly in the material that's been released so far, what we're seeing is references to particular pockets of funding to strengthen what they're calling local food infrastructure, but giving money to food banks and community food programs under the illusion that somehow that will improve, you know, people's access to food. So when you look at the policy, it starts by acknowledging that, you know, in Canada, we have a substantial problem of food insecurity. 1 in 8 households are food insecure. Mm-hmm. It also acknowledges that that problem is even more extreme in the northern region. But then what have we got in the policy? Well, very sort of small amounts of money being applied to food-based responses without any accountability for the effectiveness of those responses. So what are they talking about doing in northern communities, recognizing their high vulnerability? Community freezers? Greenhouses? I mean, really small gestures. The local food infrastructure, the example that was given in the budget this year, was of some couple that are running some food bank in Northwest Territories. And there's this story about how, you know, they had some local farmer donating raspberries and they, you know, they couldn't, I don't know, I guess for whatever reason, they weren't distributing the raspberries quickly enough. They wanted a way to preserve them, but they didn't have one. With this new fund, they'll be able to apply and get a freezer for the food bank so that they can freeze the raspberries and then ration them out in however they see fit over, I guess, the winter period. Now, I don't know if you know where Haight River is, but we're not exactly talking about the raspberry capital. Mm-hmm. This has to have been not a particularly large amount of food. And if you, everything we know about food insecurity is that people aren't just missing raspberries. So the idea that we'd have the federal government in 2019 coming forward with this as if it was an intelligent and meaningful and, you know, important response, so important that they would put this anecdote in the budget, suggests that they really don't understand the problem at all.
Valerie insists that the information is available if only people choose to use it.
In 2019, Canada has about 15 years of monitoring data. We have an enormous amount of information about who's food insecure and why and what it's doing to them. So there's no excuse. So we start with what's the very sort of starting point, building block of food security at a household level. It's at income adequacy. So that means helping households that are, you know, working but unable to garner enough money through their jobs, either because they're part-time, short-term, contingent, precarious workers mm-hmm. in low-wage employment, or people on social assistance, people on other sorts of income supports that are insufficient to meet basic needs. That's the beginning. When we've seen policies introduced that have improved the incomes of people at the very bottom end, guess what? Their food insecurity decreases. So we know that is effective. What needs to happen in Nunavut? Well, it's more complicated there. Absolutely, somebody needs to be paying attention to income. But one of the things that is really distressing about the demographics of food insecurity in Canada is the way in which Indigenous peoples are disproportionately affected. Racialized populations are also disproportionately affected, even after we take into account issues of income, home ownership, assets, other sorts of things. Over the last, I don't know, decade, 20 years, we've seen a growing awareness in Canada of the very problematic ways in which our public sector has treated Indigenous peoples historically, right? I mean, a few years ago, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission come out with a report that was just horrific in outing the problems with the relationship between federal provincial governments and Indigenous populations. More recently, we've seen this report on murdered and missing Indigenous women. I mean, these are these huge efforts that have happened at a national level with federal funding. What they're revealing to us is, I think, the toll of colonization on Indigenous peoples. I've heard Indigenous leaders speak about food insecurity as a project of colonization. It's no accident that those communities are so hard hit by these problems, and that the solutions, you know, ostensible solutions that are being put forward in things like this national food policy document are, you know, a community freezer. There's a need for much, much more substantive dialogue with Indigenous leaders and a problem-solving activity that goes beyond simply the provision of, I don't know, funds for a greenhouse. I mean, you know, we need to get to the root of this, which is extreme kind of economic marginalization, but also a legacy that has come from our history with residential schools. So, you know, there's the problem in the North is more complicated than us simply talking about how food is acquired, how food is grown, how food is transported. It's also about how come we've got communities that are so struggling to make ends meet. What's going on there? You know, it's not as simple as us talking about food. I mean, the problem of food insecurity that's being identified with our statistics, like 3 out of 4 children living in food insecure situations up there, that needs to be seen as the canary in the coal mine. But that's what it is, right? I mean, that's a stark figure that tells us there's something very, very wrong.
So you're saying, you know, figures like that aren't, those, we don't have to simply address those figures, but figure out what those tell us, that there's more information behind them.
We have to look at what's behind them, because if we just look at them on the surface, we'll come back with dumb ideas like, you know, more money for community freezers or freezers in a food bank, right? You know, we've got to go beyond that. But also, only when we go beyond that are we actually going to have an intervention that's going to move the needle on those numbers. I mean, earlier I talked to you about the Nutrition North program and this study that we've done that showed a very, very substantial increase in food insecurity over the period of time that we've seen, you know, a change in federal government, but government after government dumping money into that program without any thinking about it. Well, 20% of the households that were captured in that study, children were going whole days without eating. Like, the levels of deprivation that exist in Canada are profound, particularly among, you know, extreme communities like the Inuit living in the North. Like, we can't wait, you know, with these trivial gestures and the idea that, you know, people would be applauding the announcement of a national food policy that doesn't even appear to have internalized the depth of the deprivation is, to me, it's unacceptable given the volume of evidence right now.
Is it incumbent on programs that want to address food insecurity in the North to shift that balance towards sort of more culturally appropriate foods?
I think that's an important element, but for me, that's an important element because it's showing respect for the Indigenous cultures. But, you know, I mean, those 20% of kids who went whole days without eating, those 20% of families, sorry, where there were children who went whole days without eating, like, we're not talking about them just not eating, you know, country foods. We're talking about them not eating at all. So there's a need to address food access more broadly. So, I mean, I think it's easy, particularly when we're talking about Indigenous groups, it's easy to get caught up in this idea of, oh, well, the problem is we need, you know, the community freezers so that people can hunt and bring, you know, animals back that will be, you know, frozen and then distributed effectively in a food bank. But those are Band-Aid solutions. With climate change, we know that some of those country foods are diminishing. They're getting hard, you know, there's a complexity here that, again, I would say we need to go beyond the food component of this problem. And do you know what the population is in Nunavut? 36,000. I mean, I've passed more than 36,000 people probably on my bicycle ride since I passed Yonge Street, right? I mean, if you think about the density of the population, 36,000 people is not very many. So the idea that we'd have a problem that's this serious, festering with these really silly random gestures, it's just, you know, there's something about that number 36,000, and they're not all food insecure. It would only be, you know, I don't know, maybe 20,000 of them or something. Like, how can we not solve that problem?
that's a look at where we are on meeting SDG number 2, zero hunger. We have a national food policy, which is a huge step, but it is definitely not the last step. In fact, it is a plan that is meant to fill the gaps, but the gaps are still there. Programs like Nutrition North fall short in so many ways, and yet organizations like the Keyuktovik Food Center are stepping up nonetheless. In the North, as with so much of Canada's biggest problems, we have to look backwards at history in order to look forward to a future of food security for all. Food is a right, but every day millions of Canadians are going hungry. The issue isn't one of availability of food, but about access, cost, and culture. To get to the goal of zero hunger by 2030, we have to completely rethink not only how we nourish ourselves, but most importantly, how we sustain each other. I'm Vicky Mochama. No Little Plans comes to you courtesy of Community Foundations of Canada. It is produced by Vocal Fry Studios on behalf of Strategic Content Labs, Canada's content marketing consultancy. Our producer is Dorsa Islami, our executive producer is Katie Jensen, and our theme music is by Elcon. And we want to give a special thank you to Jimmy Thompson for chatting with our shoppers in Rankin Inlet. If you want to learn more about food security or the SDGs, check out alliance2030.ca. It's a website created by Community Foundations of Canada to track SDG efforts across Canada. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, subscribe, and share as it helps other people find the show. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at No Little Podcast. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts and join us as we look at the big plan to reshape the world.